So now we have come to the second chapter. It's also the beginning of the second major portion of the text. How do we take the Bodhisattva vow? Now, taking the Bodhisattva vow, we've talked a bit about bodhicitta. Taking the Bodhisattva vow, there's the bodhicitta of aspiration, the bodhicitta of the bodhicitta of engagement, engaged in aspirational bodhicitta. And as I said, there are different traditions for how the vow is taken. So with these different traditions, basically the different traditions come down from who they're passed down from. There is the tradition that started with Nagarjuna, it's passed down through Aryadeva and eventually to Shantideva. And this is in this tradition, one takes the vow of aspirational bodhicitta and the vow of engaged bodhicitta together. You take them at the same time. Now, we might not actually start doing the engaged work right away, but you take the vows at the same time. The other tradition started with Asanga. Am I using all these Indian names that you don't know who I'm talking about? Probably. I'm not sure what to do about it. You can ask me about who they are if you want later. So Asanga was a great 4th century master. Nagarjuna, according to the Tibetan tradition, lived for about 900 years. He was most active in the 2nd century. Current scholars say that he was a 2nd century master, and that there are actually two Nagarjunas, which is why there are different texts that were from different periods that are attributed to Nagarjuna. The Tibetan tradition is that he was a great bodhisattva who had the power to live about basically as long as he wanted to live. The Asanga was a 4th century master. He was also a great bodhisattva, but there's no story of him living for a particularly long time. So Nagarjuna and his younger half-brother Vasubandhu started what's called the Yogacharya tradition. And in their tradition, you first take the vow of aspirational bodhicitta, and then once you've gotten good at aspiring, then you take engaged bodhicitta. So there are benefits to both of these traditions. They're both valid traditions, and both traditions are still practiced in Tibetan Buddhism. Although I think because Shantideva's presentation of the Bodhisattva vow is so simple to do, I think most people take and give the Bodhisattva vow according to the tradition of Shantideva, which is the tradition of Nagarjuna. Now, these traditions are given different names depending upon which school you are associated with. In our Kagyu school, we call the tradition that comes from Nagarjuna the tradition of profound view. And the tradition that comes from Asanga, we call the tradition of vast conduct. It's also called the Yogacharya tradition. In some schools, they say that the tradition that came from Nagarjuna is the Madhyamaka, or the middle way view, and therefore superior. The tradition that came from Asanga is a mind-only school, and it's not as good a view, so it's not as good a vow. But this is a very problematic vow, because no matter which school, whether you're the school, forget about whether or not there's any difference between the two schools ultimately. And forget about the question of, is Asanga actually a mind-only teacher in ultimate terms, and that tradition, does it only teach mind-only? That's a whole different set. But if you say that one bodhisattva vow is somehow better than the other, it gets a little bit problematic. Are we saying that the Buddhahood that comes from Nagarjuna's tradition is better than the Buddhahood that comes from Asanga's tradition? I mean, after all, it was Maitreya who taught Asanga, the Bodhisattva Maitreya. So it's difficult to say that ultimately they're different in any level. But you do hear, especially if you speak with people from the Kiluk and the Sakya tradition, they will talk about them as being the bodhisattva vows from the tradition of the mind only in the middle way. But in our Kagyu tradition, we don't accept that there's that difference. We don't use those terms. We call this tradition that we are talking about now with Shantideva the tradition of profound view. View doesn't do much good if you don't act on it. And action doesn't do much good if you don't have the view. So both traditions are really quite necessary. Now, to take the bodhisattva vow, it takes an incredible amount of merit to do this. Now, merit is a concept that we talk a lot about. We talk about dedicating the merit, earning merit, gathering the accumulation of merit. So sometimes it might sound like we're accumulating gold stars, merit gold stars that we're plugging on our little, report card. But there's, actually there's nothing like that. I mean, when it comes down to it, Buddhism is a very practical. We don't assert that there are things, extra things. We don't need to invent extra categories or extra things to go into some sort of metaphysics. We're really just talking about what we can actually see. And what we can actually see are the five aggregates, our bodies and our minds, essentially. So there's nothing other than our bodies and our minds that is merit. There is no karma, nothing other than our body or our mind. So our minds are what, when we talk about merit, what we're really talking about is training our minds to be virtuous. Because our minds work a lot on habituation, training and habituation. So we do good things, and it creates the habit for doing more good things. And so when we talk about accumulating merit, what we're talking about doing is accumulating positive habits of mind, essentially. So it's not some metaphysical extra category or phenomenon that is our universal or whatever you want to call it. It's just, what are we doing? How are we training our mind? So if we're training it in merit, if you have enough positive training of your mind, then you naturally think positive thoughts. You have to be able to really think positive thoughts to have bodhicitta. So that's why we gather the accumulation of merit. So as part of that, during the bodhisattva vow ceremony, we need to start the bodhisattva vow ceremony by accumulating merit. There are many ways. Basically, anything virtuous you do is gathering merit. And what determines whether something's virtuous is, as I said before, non-greed, non-hatred, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. What these produce is virtue. The acts that these produce are virtue. So if it's motivated by an absence of greed, an absence of hatred, an absence of delusion, in other words, if you have the roots of virtuous acts, a clear understanding, not acting out of greed, not acting out of aversion, then that's a virtuous action. But there are different scales of virtue. And in the sutra tradition, one of the best ways to accumulate virtue is by what's called the seven branch. We call it the seven branch prayer. Sometimes we call it the seven branch offering. It's not quite a prayer, because actually you have to imagine doing the offerings and so forth. It's not just an offering, because there are different aspects to it. But at any rate, it's seven different aspects, a sequence of seven different actions that we do that gather the accumulation of merit. And so the text of this vow, the text of the way the bodhisattva goes through these seven branches, and then comes to the seven branches with the addition of going for refuge, and then we have the actual bodhisattva vow. So the seven branches, there are different presentations of them. The most well-known one, the one most frequently done, is the version from the Noble Aspiration for Excellent Conduct, which is from the Gandavyuha Sutra. And in this one, it's prostrations, offerings, confession, rejoicing, exhorting the Buddhists to turn the wheel of the Dharma, requesting that they don't pass into nirvana, and making dedication. So the seven are prostrations, offering, confession, rejoicing, requesting the Buddha to turn the wheel of Dharma, requesting the Buddha's not pass into Nirvana, and dedicating the merit. Each of these is said to be greater merit than the previous. They're also said to be, each of them is a particular antidote for a particular affliction. Like prostrating is an antidote towards pride. Because who's going to, if you're too proud, you're not going to bend down and put your knees and forehead on the ground. You're too proud to do it. So you have to have a certain amount of humility to be able to do it. Offering is an antidote for stinginess. You could say stinginess. Some people prefer it when you say miserliness. You want to hold on to things. You don't want to give them away. You're giving them away. Asking the Buddhas to turn the wheel of the Dharma is an antidote for delusion. Rejoicing is an antidote for envy. So each of these is an antidote for a specific different affliction. There are also but these seven branches appear in different sutras and different orders, and you can really. I've been at a last year there was a conference when someone, put up a screen with a table showing, the different. This sutra says this. This sutra says that. This source says this. So you can go through and you can talk about the order of it in different ways. The order here is a little bit different than the order in the Noble Aspiration for Excellent Conduct. This one, the order here starts with offerings. And then there's the prostrations. And you could say that both of these are actually types of offerings, and that the offerings are making material or imagined offerings, and they're making offerings of, what would you say, things, for lack of a better word. And the offerings of prostration and praise would be offerings of respect. So, at any case, here we are starting with offerings, and this is like the antidote for stinginess. Basically, what we're talking about here is generosity. And when you talk about generosity, as Shantideva describes later on in the text, generosity is the wish to give. That's what we mean by generosity. It's more the wish to give. That in the Mahayana Dharma, what's most important is your mind. That's what we're working with. So it's more important to have the wish to give than to do the actual giving. Because if actual giving were what perfected generosity, then the Buddha hasn't given everything to everyone yet, and there are still beggars in the world. How could the Buddha have possibly perfected generosity? There are still beggars. Mahayana, other responses, that's not the perfection of generosity. The perfection of generosity is perfecting the wish to give. So that's what is most important. Now, with generosity, there are two types of generosity, generally. And we talk about being generous, making gifts to the downtrodden, to those who are, to the needy, and so forth. And we talk about making offerings to those who are greater than ourselves. So making offerings to the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the spiritual masters, the Sangha, and so forth, to the Dharma, to the Three Jewels. Now, when we make offerings, for it to really be a selfless, wish to give, to really be a bodhisattva's giving. Of course, a bodhisattva's giving is you don't have any conception of yourself as a real existing thing, the person you're giving to as a real existing person, and the thing that you're giving as a real existent thing. You see it all as like the play of interdependence. We're all related to each other, and by giving and helping out something, someone else, it's purified of these three spheres of conception. You see it as like giving in a dream. There's no inherent existence to any of the, either the giver or the recipient or the gift. The action of giving itself is illusory. So there's no attachment to what we give. There's no attachment to giving. There's no attachment to ourselves, no attachment to others. There's no, therefore, no expect for a reciprocation. You know, we're not giving gifts with strings attached, is basically what it's saying. We're talking about generosity of a bodhisattva. And we're making, when we're making the offerings, in particular making the offerings to take the bodhisattva vows, it's important that we do them without any strings attached, not thinking, okay, I'm going to get something in return. It's like we're making offerings to the Buddhas and the bodhisattvas in order to develop bodhicitta within ourselves. The Buddhas and the bodhisattvas, they don't need our gifts. They don't need flowers. They don't need incense. They don't need all the other things we're offering here, the incense and perfumes from divine worlds and so forth, wish-fulfilling trees, jewel trees. They don't need them because they're happy as they are. It's instead for us to train our minds that we make these offerings. Now, one thing that I've noticed sometimes, I think, different nationalities have different sort of, habits or different sort of proclivities. And I find that Americans tend to be very generous, but especially in terms of giving thanks. Which is good. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that at all. It's good. And it's sort of like, sometimes it seems like we give offerings, like someone's done something good, so you give them extra. What I notice is when traveling with Rinpoche and other monks, like, people will give me more because they're grateful to me as a translator than to maybe some of the other monks. Or you give more to Lobsang, because he's Rinpoche's attendant. You go to the monastery, and people come to Asia, and they come to the monastery, and someone is really helpful to them. And so they give that person an extra gift. And yet, we as Americans, partially because of our culture, we don't think, well, we should give to all the monks and nuns in the monastery and the nunnery. In fact, that one who's helping you is not an extraordinary monk or nun. There's just like an ordinary monk or nun who happens to be in the position where they can help you. And the other ordinary monks and nuns aren't in that position where they can help you, you know? They're studying, or they're in school, or whatever. But when they're put in those jobs where they need to do the things to help, they by and large will do exactly the same help for all the people as the other monks who happen to be put in those jobs where they're working in the guest house, doing this in the office or that. So it's like, when we give to only a few out of thanks, then in some ways we're like neglecting others. So like not just, so when we give, giving out of thanks is good, and I'm not saying anything bad about that, but what's really important is that we give for people irregardless of what they've done for us. When we're making a gift to the people who are to people who need it, it doesn't matter if this one homeless person smiles at you and the other person frowns at you, so you give it to the one who smiles at you and seems to like have a cheery attitude. It's not like that. They both need the money. They both need meals. So it's important for us to think about having a broader attitude. So what I'd like to ask is, for those who are thinking of either taking for the first time or retaking the bodhisattva vows for tomorrow, when we actually take the vows in the afternoon, you should come and make offerings. You should bring something to make an offering, flowers, incense, something nice. No expectations. Just bring as nice a thing as you can, or as nice things. And then we can maybe if there's someone who's particularly artistic, or if you all want to work out together, we can make a nice arrangement of things here. We've got kind of a small space right here, so we might need to move me over. That's fine by me. The cable's long enough. We can do it so that it's important when we actually take the bodhisattva that vow that, there's... there's a line in here. Shantideva, as Busuku, of course, had nothing to give because he didn't do anything. He had nothing. He was a monk. I am bereft of merit, destitute, and have no other wealth that I could offer. May the protectors who think of others will accept these through the power of my own sake. He's offering everything in the world that's unowned. And he's a beggar monk. He has nothing, literally. He has the three Dharma robes, and that's it. We don't. We aren't like that. So when taking the Bodhisattva vow tomorrow, think about bringing something that you can make a nice offering. We might end up with piles of flowers here, incense, lamps, candles. I don't think we can light all the candles in here all at once because of fire regulations. We have to be careful about that. So we don't want to do anything that's going to violate fire regulations. Think about coming and doing something that you're going to feel like you're actually making a gift. And so what makes the difference, because again, there are people of different means here, and some of you may have more difficulty than others. You should give something that you feel like you're giving something you can give and that you're happy to give. But it's like something that feels like you're making a kind of a significant offering. It's not just like a $3 thing, candle. Okay, here's a candle. Maybe for you, $3 for a candle is a lot, but just try to do something, try to push yourself a little bit to do this. And this will be, these are offerings for the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. If they're like flowers, we can arrange them, they can stay here, and they'll look nice for a few days, and then eventually you can compost them. If it's candles and so forth, candles are burned here on the altar all the time. If it's food offerings, then maybe we can distribute it to a homeless shelter tomorrow night or something. I don't know. We can figure that out tomorrow, right? So just try to do this. I think it'll be a interesting for us all to do. The other reason I'm suggesting this is that I've noticed as I've traveled that I go to places where there are lots of Chinese people and it's cultural for them. They go and they make offerings and they're these huge, beautiful, beautiful offerings. And we come to, I'm not going to, these are really nice flowers, actually, and these are pretty good, too. It's a nice arrangement. I mean, they're nice arrangements, but I like these arrangements. It looks good, but, in terms of quantity, the Asians really do quantity. So we set up, some really nice Japanese ikebana flower arrangement, and it's like, oh, it's just perfect. This is our offering. Well, we can also do the abundant offering, not just class. Let's just try for an abundant offering tomorrow, if that works for all of you. And I think we can do it on a kind of ad hoc way. We don't need to organize it. Everything will be welcome, and we'll put it up, and it will all be beautiful. Okay? So that being said, let's go on with the text of this. So we're getting to offering. So the most important thing is offering with our minds. In order to grasp that precious attitude, I make fine offerings to the Tathagatas, to the true Dharma, the Immaculate Jewel, and to the oceans of qualities, Bodhisattvas. So in order to grasp that precious attitude here means bodhicitta. And grasp it here means to take the vow. So what he's saying here, in order that we can take the Bodhisattva vow, we first are making offerings, and we're making the offerings to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. So these are such as the offerings we've put out here, the seven traditional offerings, the flowers, incense, and so forth. The food. Oh, I like the pumpkin. The food offering, So we're making these offerings to the Tathagatas. This is another name for the Buddha. Tata means thusness. It means the nature. Gata means, as we spoke about last night, either going or realizing. So those who have realized thusness, those who have gone to thusness. To the true Dharma, the Immaculate Jewel, the Dharma being the teachings of the Buddha, and to the oceans of qualities, Bodhisattvas. So this is like the offerings we have. Now following this, the next section is the section on offering everything that is not owned. So for monastics, monastics are only supposed to have the 13 requisites. And back at the time, and at Nalanda, they were very strict at it. You only had the 13 requisites. You didn't have anything else. books were supposed to go in the library. I guess we're not so good about this. I think I have more than the 13 requisites. I think I have more than this in the small bag I packed to come up to Portland. I feel kind of ashamed of myself when I talk about this sort of thing. But at any rate, you know, for someone like Shantideva, he didn't have anything of his own besides his robes, his alm bowl, a water filter, and such. So in order to make an offering, he imagined that he was taking everything in the world that is unknown and offering it to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. And so he describes that here. As many fruits and flowers as there are, whatever kinds of medicine exist. Medicine here also meaning medicinal herbs. We're not talking about pharma. However many jewels there are in the world, all clean and pleasant waters there may be. Mountains of jewels and likewise forest groves and solitary and delightful places, bushes adorned with ornamental flowers and trees whose branches bow with splendid fruit. Incense and perfumes as from divine worlds and so forth, wish-fulfilling trees, jewel trees, and crops that grow without the need to be plowed, all ornaments that are fit to be offered. And lakes and pools bedecked with lotuses, where lovely swans have most delightful calls. Everything that's unowned, extending to the edges of the realms of infinite space. I imagine taking these and offer them well to the sages, greatest of beings and their offspring. Sublime and greatly compassionate recipients, think of me lovingly, accept these from me. I am bereft of merit, destitute, and have no other wealth that I could offer. May the protectors who think of others will accept these through their power for my sake. So, when we offer, we think, I'm going to offer all the lakes that are not owned. Are there any unloaned lakes in the United States? We have a different conception of property here, but okay. Sebago Lake, you know. All of the lakes around here, the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, all of these oceans, all of the wealth in the oceans, all of the bounty in the oceans, all of the land, all of the bounty in the land, things that are unowned, you know, all of the forests, all of the trees, the birds, everything there that's unknown. We're imagining that we're taking them and offering them to the Buddha. And not just, you know, not just ordinary ones, but beautiful ones, the trees that are laden with fruit, the apple trees, the peach trees, all of these we're offering to the Buddhas. In verse 4, where it talks about wish-fulfilling trees and jewel trees, these are the trees that grow, according to the traditional cosmology, they grow in the realms of the gods. The wish-fulfilling trees are trees where the gods go, and if they want for anything they wish, and they just falls off the branches into their hands, essentially. They can get whatever they want off of the trees, off of the branches. They're jewel trees, trees covered with jewels, and crops that grow without the need to be plowed. At the beginning of the eons, according to the traditional cosmology, all of the grains and so forth don't need to be plowed. They naturally grow on their own, and people can enjoy them. It's when people start feeling greed for them that they stop growing naturally and they have to be tilled. Lakes and pools bedecked with lotuses, where lovely swans have most delightful calls. So we're imagining that we're offering the most beautiful and the best things that we can find in the natural world, everything that we can offer to the Buddhas to please them. And we're doing this, we're making this offering to the sages, that means the Buddhas, who are the greatest of the beings, and their offspring, the Bodhisattvas. And so accept them through your power for my sake. This is offering what is not owned. Now, Shantideva also offers his body, all of his bodies, not just this one body, but all the bodies into the future. Forevermore, I offer all my bodies to the victorious ones and to their offspring. O sublime ones, accept me entirely, and I will be your dedicated servant. Because you have accepted me completely, not fearing existence, I will benefit beings. I will transcend my previous misdeeds and never do another wrong again. So here it's saying, this is not literally saying, okay, Buddha, here's my body, take it. It's not like that. It's saying, offering the bodies to the Buddha. It's like offering ourselves to use our bodies to serve the Buddha, to serve the Dharma, to serve the teachings. Offering our bodies to them. Because we have offered ourselves to the Buddha, we know that we are under the protection of the Buddha. We have taken refuge in the Buddha. We are under the Buddha's protection. And so we do not fear existence. We know that we'll benefit, we'll bring benefit to sentient beings. So that's offering our bodies. So following this section, we imagine that we're making mentally emanated offerings. So this is where we imagine the Buddha in front of ourselves, and we imagine that we're making offerings of ablution, which means it's a fancy way of saying bathing. Bathing the Buddha, offering robes, adornments, and so forth. So this is not actually making physical offerings. It's not like we go up to the Buddha and say, "Here, Buddha, let me give you a wash." It's not like that. Instead, it's imagining that you're offering this. If any of you have watched the Kajumunlam videos on the internet when it happens every year in Bodh Gaya, or also when it happens in North America, you might have seen that there's a portion in the first morning session where we're offering ablution, and the shrine master, or sometimes His Holiness, usually on the first day, His Holiness, the Karmapa will hold up. First, while we're making offering, he'll stand, offering the ablution, he'll stand by the Buddha and then ladle water over a small statue of the Buddha. So this is actually something that we can do. We could also do it ourselves if we wanted, but we'll not do it tomorrow just for sake of simplicity. So we need to have a bathable Buddha, which I don't think, I'm not sure if we have it. I don't know if this Buddha would stand for a bath, if it would help the statue to be bathed. So there are statues that are more suitable for washing. So they actually pour the water, you know, take beautiful water, a bowl of water with flower petals, and the Karmapa will pour the water over the Buddha. And then after that, you know, he holds up a cloth, usually a white kata, but it could be a white cotton towel, a beautiful towel, and imagine drying the Buddha's. Then he holds up a saffron-colored kata, or you can hold up saffron-colored cloth, and imagine that you're offering robes to the Buddha. And so there is a ritual that you can do to actually do this to actually imagine doing this. It's sort of like a support for doing it. When we're bathing a statue of the Buddha, that statue of the Buddha, you could say, it's not a Buddha, why are we bathing it? What's the good in doing it? It's not. It's true that that statue is made out of either metal or clay, or maybe sometimes with the washable ones, maybe they're made out of plastic, I don't know. At any rate, that statue is made out of physical things that are not the physical body of the Buddha. But it's the shape that they're made in. It's made in a particular shape that reminds us of the Buddha. When we see the shape of the Buddha, then we're reminded of the qualities of the Buddha. And so therefore, when we're paying veneration, we're not paying veneration to this thing that's made out of metal or stone or clay or whatever material. Because of the material it's made out of, we're paying homage to it because it reminds us of the qualities of the Buddha. So when we do the ritual with bathing the Buddha and offering the clothes and so forth, that's what we're doing. We're training our mind. And so the text reads, "Within the sweetly fragrant house for bathing, where the bright and lustrous floors are paved with crystal, alluring pillars are aglow with jewels, and glistening pearls are draped in canopies, I bathe the Sugatas and Bodhisattvas from precious vases that have been filled full of water imbued with many fragrances, accompanied by song and instruments." So that's offering the bathing. Excuse me. Offering the bathing of the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas. And so one thing you can imagine is that you imagine that as you are doing this, as you are reciting the text, you can imagine the Buddhas and all the Bodhisattvas in front of you in a house like this. And here you don't have to visualize it clearly like a Vajrayana meditation. You can just sort of imagine that they're there. You don't have to picture them perfectly. It's just like saying they're there, and you imagine that you and traditionally they say offering goddesses, you know, celestial beings go and offer the bathing of the Buddhas. So it continues next with the offering of robes. "And then I offer them the finest robes, well dyed and most delightfully perfumed. I draped Samantabhadra, Lokeshvara, Manjushri, and the other noble beings that are with fabrics that are delicate and soft and hundreds of the finest ornaments. So here we've got actually two offerings of robes and ornaments. The first two lines, I offer them the finest robes, well dyed and most delightfully perfumed. This is offering the Dharma robes to the Buddha who appears in the form of the Supreme Nirmanakaya, is what we call. That's basically the form of the Buddha that we are most familiar with. The Buddha in this form doesn't wear any ornaments. He wears the simple three Dharma robes. So we imagine that we're offering the Dharma robes that are made out of the finest fabrics that have a beautiful scent to them. Then the second verse, I drape Samantabhadra, Lokeshvara, and Manjushri, and the other noble beings with fabrics that are delicate and soft, and so forth. These Manjushri, Samantabhadra, Lokeshvara, Manjushri, these are three of the eight close sons. These are three of the great bodhisattvas. So here we're offering bodhisattvas. Now, bodhisattvas appear as like in the royal form, so we're offering them what traditional Indian kings would wear. So this would be beautiful fabrics and ornaments, crowns, three different types of necklaces, ear ornaments, shoulder ornaments, bangles on the wrists and ankles, and jeweled belts and so forth. All of the beautiful royal ornaments, and also the fabrics that are delicate and soft, beautiful royal fabrics. And that's offering the robes. Then we imagine that we're offering scents. So India is a very hot country. And one of the things you can do to help with the heat is to rub camphor on your chest. So it's one thing that there is a custom of rubbing camphor on people's chests to help them feel cool and comfortable in the heat. So here it says, like polishing the purest refined gold, I apply the finest scents whose fragrances waft everywhere throughout the billion worlds to the radiant bodies of the Sugatas. So we're offering this. We see that, you know, you imagine that they're radiant Buddhas whose bodies are glowing and radiant. You're offering them this offering of scents and perfumes and cooling, delicious scents. Then we imagine that we're offering them flowers. So this, again, is a mentally imagined offering. I offer the great beings I venerate, the lords of sages, every fragrant flower, mandarava, lotus, jasmine, and so forth, and pleasing garlands strung attractively. So making all the different types of flowers. If you have trouble picturing mandarava flowers, I think dahlias and peonies and all these flowers are also wonderful. You don't have to limit yourself when you're making an offering of flowers to thinking, well, the text says mandarava, so I have to imagine a mandarava flower. You can just imagine beautiful flowers. Next, we have two lines for offering incense. I also offer billowing clouds of incense filled with the sweetest, most enchanting scents. Then two lines offering food and royal feasts. I offer them as well, replete with an assortment of food and drink. Two lines are offering of lamps. I make an offering of jeweled lamps and arranged in rows on gold lotuses. So you've got the stands, like you've got the lamps here, it's like candles, and the candle holders are shaped like lotus, golden lotuses, and they're arranged in beautiful rows. It's not just sort of like haphazard wherever you're going to stick them, but you've got a nice arrangement of it. It's like when you're making arrangements and offerings, it's nice to put them out in a way that really looks good and that is pleasing to the eyes, instead of just sort of, if you come in with all sorts of, you know, nice stuff, but you sort of throw it on a heap on the floor and say, here, have it. Mm-hmm. Not as nice. You have nice things. You put them in a beautiful order. You arrange them nicely. Sometimes in the Korean tradition, they make these stacks of fruit. So you've got these apples that are stacked on each other. You know, these big... They hold them together with tape. But from far away, they look really nice. Where did I get to? Okay. Next is offering a beautiful place to stay. And again, this is just imagined. And you don't have to be detailed in the imagining. Just imagine you're making this offering. I scatter the petals of attractive flowers on a paved floor anointed with a perfume. I offer those who are compassionate numberless palaces adorning the sky, beautifully glowing with strings of pearls and jewels, and echoing with melodious songs of praises. Next is offering parasols. Parasols are very important in hot countries, and they're also signs of royalty, because when you see that parasol, you can tell where the king is. When you see the parasol in a Buddhist procession, you know where the Lama, where the king, or where the Buddha or the Lama is. I also always offer to the lords of sages beautiful jeweled parasols with golden staves, fine-shaped, upright, and pleasing to the eye, their rims festooned with winsome ornaments. Next is an offering of song and music, and furthermore, may they extend clouds of attractive offerings with lovely tunes and instruments that soothe all beings' sufferings. Then an offering of aspirations aspirations of offerings, may rains of gems and flowers and more continuously shower down on all the jewels of the true Dharma, as well as on stupas and likenesses, so on statues. Now, you don't need to be too literal about this. If you start wondering, if jewels start raining down and everyone's getting pelted with jewels, don't be literal, okay? Just think beautiful things going, okay? As Manju Ghosha and the others made offerings to the victorious ones, I offer to the Tathagatas, the protectors, and their offspring. So when the great bodhisattvas, such as Manjushri, so Manjushri and Manju Ghosha are both same name, or different names, same bodhisattva, when they enter great samadhi, because of the power of their samadhi, they're able to emanate immense, beautiful offerings that they then offer to the Buddhas. And so this is saying, may we also be able to develop that samadhi where we can also make these unsurpassable offerings ourselves. So following that, that was the offerings. The next we have the prostrations and praise, and these two are going together. I extol the qualities, I extol the oceans of qualities with the oceans of melodies of praise. May clouds of hymns and praise of them arise just so continuously. I prostrate, bowing as many bodies as there are atoms in all realms, to all the Buddhas of the three times, to the Dharma and the sublime Sangha. I prostrate to the sacred sites and the stupas of the Bodhisattva. I also prostrate to the abbots, the masters, and the supreme adepts. So here, offering prostrations or prostrating to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. Now, when we prostrate, like when we do prostrations to the Buddha at the beginning of a class, or when you prostrate to a master, it's always good to concentrate when you're prostrating. Sometimes it's hard to, because there's so much going on in a situation, but it's good to concentrate and to imagine that you aren't just prostrating on your own. You imagine that, like, there are a million of your bodies that you prostrate, that you emanate out, and you're all of your bodies, along with all sentient beings throughout space, are all prostrating simultaneously. So it's not just one measly prostration, but billions upon billions of prostrations all simultaneously, all sentient beings and millions of yourself bowing to the Buddha. And then when you're reciting the praises of the Buddha, of course we are ordinary beings who have only one head and only one tongue. But what you do is you imagine that you have your millions of bodies, and each of these bodies has 1,000 heads. Each of the 1,000 heads has 100 tongues, and each of those, or 1,000 tongues, and each of those tongues is reciting 100 praises of the Buddha. So like one praise becomes an immeasurable number of praises. This is kind of hard. Again, please don't be too literal in terms of thinking about it. Just think that instead of just being little me, limited me, but, you know, immense amounts of praise and, that we're offering all at that time. But it is a kind of a funny image. So prostrating to the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the sublime Sangha. Prostrating to the sacred sites, the sites such as Bodh Gaya, Lumbini, the sites of the Buddha, and stupas of the Bodhisattva. That means the places where the relics of the previous incarnations of the Buddha are. And also to abbots, masters, and supreme adepts. So the abbots And the masters, the teachers, they're the ones who give us the who have given us the ability to practice practice these teachings. And here, of course, abbots or abbesses, masters, or the female equivalent of masters. I think masters can be non-gender specific. Doesn't matter, male or female, whatever. You know, just as easily Khanda Rinpoche as any other Rinpoche, Jetsun Ma in Seattle, any of their great masters, it doesn't matter. All of the beings, gender is not important. What's important is we are paying homage to those who give us the opportunity to practice Dharma, no matter who they are, what form they take. So this completes the offerings and prostrations. And we've come to the next verse, which is going for refuge. There are two levels of refuge. There's the common form of refuge, and then there's Mahayana refuge. When we take the refuge vow, we take the refuge vow in the common tradition first. And it's important to take this refuge vow for many reasons. When we're going for refuge, it's like we have to recognize that we experience a lot of suffering and samsara, and we don't know how to extricate ourselves from the suffering. And in fact, that what we think will free ourselves from suffering often just perpetuates our suffering. We have so many negative thought patterns, or so many confused thought patterns that we continually just perpetuate, increase our suffering rather than actually extricating ourselves. We're just digging ourselves deeper and deeper in. If we knew how to save ourselves from suffering, none of us would suffer. So we need some sort of protection. We need someone who can tell us, how do we get out of suffering? It would be nice if there were someone who could just sort of pluck us out of suffering and put us in happiness. But it doesn't work that way. Otherwise, if it were possible, we wouldn't be suffering, because someone would have plucked us out. If the Buddha in his infinite compassion had the ability to free our suffering, the Buddha would. So the Buddha doesn't miraculously take us away from suffering. What the Buddha does is the Buddha teaches the path . So when we go for refuge to the Buddha, we go for refuge to the Buddha as the teacher, the person who's teaching us the path of what it is we need to do and what it is that we need to avoid. We need to do virtuous things, and in particular, we need to do the practice of the six paramitas, and in the Mahayana context, the six paramitas. We need to practice, or in the general context of Buddhism, we need to practice virtue, and what we need to give up is we need to avoid, we need to shun non-virtuous actions. And in order to do this, we need to tame our mind. And so the Buddha has taught us the methods to tame our own mind. So we go for refuge to the Buddha as our teacher, who teaches the path to do this and bring ourselves to freedom from suffering. And the path that the Buddha teaches is what we call the Dharma. The Dharma, and when you say path, it's a metaphor, of course. It's not like we ash are necessarily stepping one foot in front of another, but it's a path in the sense that we're taking a spiritual journey. We're going to Buddhahood. We're following the path to free ourselves from suffering, going from samsara to nirvana. Nirvana is basically just the absence of suffering, the absence of the afflictions, the absence of ignorance. We have to follow the path, and so the Dharma is the teachings that will take us there. But we can't go there alone. So when we go there, we need to have companions on the path. So these are the members of the Sangha. The Sangha, traditionally the Sangha referred to two types of Sangha. There is the noble Sangha, which means beings who have achieved the bodhisattva levels, who have achieved the path of seeing. They naturally, because of their degree of realization, because of their degree of realization, they're naturally worthy, they're naturally able to give us protection. They're naturally able to show us the way. In other words, they've had experience. They're able to show us what we need. The other type of sangha traditionally described is the monastic sangha. So a gathering of four or more bhikkhus would be a sangha. Often in early translations to English, they translated the word sangha as order. So in some ways it's similar. It's like an order. You take vows and you enter an order. You take vows and you enter the monastic sangha. And it's traditionally it's been the monastic sangha, the monks and nuns who have preserved the teachings and who have protected the teachings and who have taught them and who are able to teach them to people. Lay people would offer the sangha a meal, and in return the sangha would give teachings. It's a traditional way from the time of the Buddha on for thousands of years. So these days we talk about sangha, and we often use it in a much broader sense, especially in the West. Actually, Asian people don't tend to use it in the sense we use sangha in the West. We use the word sangha in the West to sort of mean our group here in the Dharma Center and in all Dharma centers, and it's very commonly used. So this is not, when we're talking about the jewel of the sangha, I'm not sure if this is included or not. It's hard to say. Maybe it's better to have pure perception. But it's important to understand that traditionally the meaning of the word sangha was different than we're using it nowadays. You're saying that we have a sangha here in Portland. Well, maybe you're all eighth level bodhisattvas. I hope you are. Monastics, it's a little different. So the reason to talk about this actually is that one of the difficulties for Western monastics, other than me, because I'm very well taken care of, is that a lot of Western monastics have difficulty maintaining their vows because they don't get enough support. And one of the reasons they don't get enough support is that people don't consider them to be separate. They think, we're part of the Sangha, they're part of the Sangha. You know, I have to pay my own way, the monastic should pay their own way. And I've heard people say things like this. Why should we give monks and nuns anything when you know, I want to go on retreat too? So it's a little bit different for the Western monks and nuns who have taken on robes. They don't have any income other than what people give them. You may think that they're good monks or nuns, or they're not good monks or nuns, but they're still someone who are trying to devote their lives to practicing, to studying, preserving Buddhism. And it's a little different. It's hard, you know, it's hard for, I mean, I can understand it's hard to know when you haven't taken the monastic vows how different it is to have a monastic outlook. I think what I'd like to say, what I'm trying to say here is that it's important that even if you use the word sangha for yourselves, for your group here, it's important to remember the original meaning of it. And in particular, it's important to aid those members of the Western sangha, unlike me, who are not well supported, who have difficulty, and many of whom end up giving back their vows because they don't have any support. In traditional Buddhist society, the lay community supported the Sangha, and it made it possible for monks and nuns to spend their whole lives devoting themselves to meditation and study. And there are a lot of Western monks and nuns who want to devote themselves to study and meditation but are unable to. They take the vows but find they have no support. So I'd like to ask you to just please keep this in mind when you see members of the Sangha, in particular Western members of the Sangha. A digression again. So when we go for refuge to the Sangha, we're going for refuge to the Sangha as our companions on the path, because they can help show us the way to achieve happiness. When we want to go for sangha, when we want to go for refuge, you know, going for refuge, we're in samsara. We want to get out of samsara. Well, what is it that we're looking for? What level of getting out of, what level of freedom from suffering are we looking for? There are different motivations we could have. You might think, I want to go for refuge now so that I can be well off in the future. This is what in Tibetan is called letmen, basically. It's aspiration for excellence, aspiring for goodness. We want to get something good. We want to be in our... traditionally, it's talked about as aspiring to be reborn as a human or a god in the next life. It could be, I want to go for refuge in order to be prosperous and happy in this life, is another example of that. But that, you know, as we've talked about, that's problematic, because no matter how happy we are in our future lives, if we haven't done anything to actually free ourselves from samsara, that happiness in the future lives is going to end. So the other motivation from samsara is fearing the suffering of samsara. We go for refuge from a wish for emancipation. Now, this is the word that most translators translate as renunciation, and there's a kind of big difference, because renunciation sort of says, all that is bad, I'm going elsewhere, I don't want it. But really, it's the wish for emancipation, the wish for freedom from samsara. You want to be liberated from samsara. So it's actually wanting something positive rather than, you know, shunning something negative. Although, in effect, it means that you are, you know, revolted by the negative. You do have to be kind of down on samsara in order to want to get out of it. You have to view it as being like a prison or a pit of fire, and really want to free yourself from it, to really have that wish of the desire for emancipation. But this is the one of the motivations of refuge that we talk about. So thinking, it's not just going for refuge in order to achieve temporary benefit. It's going for refuge in order to achieve permanent benefit. That's the benefit of liberation. Now, when we go for refuge in the common tradition, we go for refuge to the Buddha as the teacher, the Dharma as the path, and the Sangha as the companions along the path. Or you could say the Dharma as teachings is another way to phrase it. And we go for refuge for the duration of this life. So from the moment we take the refuge vow until we pass away, then we try to uphold the three refuges of going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha. This means that we don't go for refuge towards worldly gods, or we don't go for refuge towards other religions, which is kind of an interesting one when you think about it. Once we go for refuge to the Buddha as the teacher, then you don't go for refuge to a worldly god. You don't go for refuge. In the context of India, it was going for refuge to Brahma or Indra or any of the other gods. In our context, it would be like going for, you know, you don't, once you've accepted the Buddha as your, as a refuge, then you no longer would accept Jesus Christ as your savior. Unless, of course, you see Jesus as being like an emanation of the Buddha. So if you're in a situation where that ISIS militant has got the gun at your head and they say, what do they say in Islam? You're going to submit, you're going to accept Allah as your only God, or else we're going to kill you. If you see at that point Allah as being an emanation of the Buddha and go for that emanation of the Buddha who is named Allah, you haven't broken your refuge vow, and the ISIS militant probably won't kill you. For some really stupid and probably racist example, I guess. I don't know. I should be ashamed of myself for something like that. But, you know, it's the understanding you have, you know, of the being. It's not like Jesus or Allah or any of the other beings that other religions postulate are bad. They're good. They encourage people to do good. And so when we understand that doing good is like the avoiding harming and doing good, that is the essence of Dharma. So when we think of them in this way, that's not breaking our refuge vow. But if we then think, I'm going for refuge to this one and giving up on the Buddha, then that's bad. In fact, even if we think to ourselves, I'm going for the refuge to the Buddha, I'm not going for refuge to Jesus Christ, I'm not going for refuge to Allah, then actually, in a sense, we have also broken our refuge vow, because we are giving up on beings who are teaching Dharma, Whether they're teaching the complete Dharma or not is an issue of debate, but there's no need to say, bad, never, this is evil, this is bad, I don't want anything to do with it. We have to have as, you know, as ecumenical an attitude as we can, see that they're all parts of it. We may have for ourselves the path of Buddhism as the path that we follow, and understand that the Buddha is the teacher who's teaching us the true way to liberation. But there are other people who may not be able to practice this path, and for them, other paths that are encouraging them to do virtuous things and discouraging them from doing negative actions are good, and that is also Dharma. So it's not an exclusive thing at all. It's important to remember that. Otherwise, we're in the danger of rejecting a form of Dharma, which is very bad. So that's the common vow of refuge, is going for refuge from now until the end of the life in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha, in particular, in the foundation vehicle, there are different different positions on this, but like in the Vaibhashika school, the great exposition school, it said that the Buddha is not, we aren't going for refuge to the body of the Buddha, because, you know, the Buddha was born a human, Prince Siddhartha, and achieved Buddhahood under the Bodhi tree. That physical body of the Buddha is not what we're going for refuge, not what we're going for refuge to. Instead, what we go for refuge to when we go for refuge to the Buddha are the qualities that make the Buddha a Buddha. We're going for refuge to the qualities of realization. Now, we may represent these with a physical form, with a physical statue, but when we have to have the understanding that by going for refuge to the Buddha, we're not going refuge to flesh and blood. We're going for refuge to the qualities of the Buddha. So this is according to the Vaibhashika school. For them, when you go for refuge to the Dharma, what you're going for refuge to is the truth of cessation, the cessation of all suffering, and the path, the truth of the path, the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to that state of cessation, nirvana. Now, in the Mahayana, we understand, of course, the Buddha differently. We talk about the Buddha as being the three kayas. We haven't got time to really go into all three kayas, but essentially what we're saying is that we're going for refuge to the Buddha that is essentially the wisdom. The Dharmakaya is like the very first line of the first chapter, or the second line, I prostrate to with respect to the Sukhatas who have the Dharmakaya, who have the wisdom, love, and power of a Buddha. And we're also going for refuge to their physical manifestations, what we call the Nirmanakayas, or the emanated bias, and the Sambhogakayas, or the enjoyment bodies of the Buddha. So that's what we go for in the Mahayana as refuge. That's what we go to for refuge in the Mahayana with the Buddha. And in the Buddha, we think, in the Mahayana, we think of the Dharma as being the truth. Again, it's the same. It's being the truths of cessation, which is the non-abiding state of nirvana, and the truth of the path of the bodhisattva levels. And the Sangha includes the Sangha of bodhisattvas. In the foundation vehicle, in the Vaibhashika, the Sangha includes, it means the any group of four or more bhikkhus. In the Mahayana, it includes the bodhisattvas on the levels. So those are the sources of refuge, and the reason they're able to give us refuge is because the Buddha is the teacher, the Dharma is the teachings, and the Sanghas are companions on the path.